The views and opinions expressed during the drive time are those of Dave Glover and his guests and are not those of Northumberland 89.7. Agree, disagree, or have a comment? Call the station and speak with Dave live on the air. Call 905-372-2321. That's 905-372-2321. Now your host, Dave Glover.
And welcome back to the Drive Time, everybody. Joining me in the studio right now is the member of Provincial Parliament for Northumberland Quinte West, Lou Rinaldi. Lou, welcome to the show. Glad to have you here.
Good to be here, Dave. Good to be here. It's been a while. Happy New Year. Merry Christmas.
All of the above. We are going to talk about 2015 for the first bit of the show anyway, about the things that have happened. And hopefully by halfway through, we'll get to some of the stuff that's coming up for 2016. When do you guys go back to the House?
The House resumes, I think it's February 15th. It's a day after Labor Day.
Oh, right on. Not Labor Day.
Family Day.
Day after Family Day. There you go.
I'm just ahead of myself. Yeah.
He's already in the summer. That's incredible. Anyway, let's talk about some of the highlights, though. I mean, the Ontario Liberal government managed to pass 78 pieces of legislation this session, and this is in the 2014-15 schedule. Ontario has committed to make an unprecedented investment of more than $130 billion in infrastructure, roughly $13 billion a year over the next 10. The province has also revised its deficit to $7.5 billion, a figure that is down the earlier projection. And I saw something on Twitter today from the Canadian Taxpayers Association saying, oh, great, the debt is this much. We're paying it off, folks. Okay, the deficit's $1 billion less than was projected, so that's good as well. Province is also on track to achieve results they said they would, including investing $50 million to support grassroots community partners, lifting people and families out of poverty. Minimum wage increased to $11.25 an hour, and future increases every year will be tied to the rate of inflation. This gives business time to plan and ensures fairness for low-income workers. They've also opened applications to small and rural northern municipalities for up to $150 million a year in community infrastructure funding, so good news there. Locally, though, they funded programs such as the Quinte West Teen Activity Sports and Rec programs, and that's to keep residents active, invested in community living Camelford, Brighton in its pilot creative project and inclusive housing projects for adults with developmental disabilities, and provided support for infrastructure needs in the town of Cobourg, the county of Northumberland, through the Ontario Community Infrastructure Investment Fund. Lots more. Lou, what for you, what was 2015 for you? I mean, we've talked, there's a lot of money on the table, obviously, a lot of work still to be done. What was the highlight for you in 2015?
Well, you know, it was a combination of local dealing with local issues and also provincial issues. We had some huge provincial pieces, for example, the trying to put together the Ontario retirement plan that's in process, will come in effect the next year about this time. The fact of bringing beer and wine to grocery stores, mm-hmm. freeing up that market, bringing that's up to close to 21st century Ontario. I mean, it's not done yet, but certainly it's in progress. So those things were more globally, of course. The other piece that's always a big part, I think, of any riding. But here I'm blessed to have three hospitals, and there's always health issues mm-hmm. related to that in a number of fronts.
Well, always issues related to the LHINs as well.
Exactly, so. Community access centers and all those things. So those things have been important. But at the same time, you don't forget some specific local stuff. I think you mentioned a couple of things that we're able to bring to the community.
Mm-hmm.
Some infrastructure funding for that the municipalities are always advocating for. Some funding for to help seniors. Some funding to help the youth stay active and mm-hmm. also give them a purpose in life.
Well, the other thing I mentioned right off the top, too, is investing $50 million to support grassroots community partners and lifting families and people out of poverty. Now, this, because you and I just spoke about this earlier today as well on TV Kojiko, but I like the aspect of this because it's tied, much like the Northumberland United Way fundraiser this year, it's tied to helping families. And so the goal isn't so much, well, we're spending this much money, but really you're focused on how many families you can lift out of poverty.
That's the goal. And the other interesting part of this, normally, governments come out with a program mm-hmm. that's in a square box or round box. This $50 million over the next 3 or 4 years is really tied in to support and pick up the process from community already doing something that's successful. So we're saying, don't let us provincially as a government tell you how to eliminate poverty, but you come up with ideas that work best in your community because, mm-hmm. The face of poverty, although poverty is poverty, it's got different faces depending on what part of the province you are. You might get to some remote communities in the north with our Aboriginal communities. They're totally different what you see down on Yonge and Bloor. And what you see right here in the writing. So the purpose of that is to engage communities at all levels mm-hmm. to come up with solutions. And some of them, we have some fantastic samples across this province. So,
well, the first thing comes to my mind locally, of course, is the Greenwood Coalition and organizations like that. Would they be somebody – would they be an organization that would be able to access this type of funding?
So we're looking at the broader community. So we encourage groups, and I think Northumberland County, through the Social Service Department, mm-hmm. and I believe one other group that although was working on it and it kind of pulled out towards the end because they didn't have all their pieces together. What the program really entails, too, that not to look at a piecemeal circumstance, but try mm-hmm. to eliminate some of these silos. The county had a very good proposal put forward. Unfortunately, they weren't successful. But talking to those folks, they're rejigging their process to their application to make sure they're successful next time. So it's mm-hmm. It's over a 3-year period, and I know that with a commitment that the local community has made to partner, they will be successful.
Well, and that sounds very positive. Now, a lot of this, of course, really sort of plays into your wheelhouse, though, because you are the parliamentary assistant. I guess that's the provincial equivalent yep. to a parliamentary secretary to the Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing. And, of course, we know that, across Northumberland County, I think the most affordable place to live right now is still Crammy, if I remember correctly. I think
Possibly.
It's still – but again, if you're in Crammy – and you have no job, you have no transportation a lot of times either. So I guess this is what you were getting at when you were talking about the different face of poverty, yeah. right?
And I mean, the challenge in rural Ontario, we're not unique. Lack of proper transportation.
Mm-hmm.
We talked earlier on today when we say that, somebody in poverty that's on Front Street and Yonge or Bloor and Yonge in Toronto sleeping on the sidewalk, it's different than Mr. or Mrs. Smith living in the fourth concession, can't afford insurance, can't afford license plate, can't afford gas. So to me, that's that's a level of poverty.
Absolutely.
And they have no means of coming to their doctor, to their dentist, mm-hmm. to visit family. So as we look at different ways to approach this, this is why the commitment from government is to go to communities at large, identify their issues, and try to put a program together that mm-hmm. the government can help and build and try to be self-sustainable. So you're right. So there might be a house in Crammy available at a reasonable price, but once those people get there, what do they do then?
Mm-hmm.
So that is a huge challenge. So we need more affordable housing. There's a number of affordable housing out there that frankly lack repair.
Mm-hmm.
And, I forget the numbers off the top of my head, but it's huge right across the province.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I think you're going to see rolling out, provincially within the next couple of months, is ways to allow communities to be more flexible. For example, Northumberland County, I believe they received some $4 million to put towards just last year towards housing needs.
So renovation if necessary.
Yeah, well, whatever the case might be. You know where it's best, the community.
Well, that was the first question, actually, I was thinking of as we were talking about your community council. What have you been hearing? I mean, we know it's different everywhere else, but here in Northumberland, Peterborough South, or Quinte West, yeah. Actually, it will be Northumberland, Peterborough South. We'll get to that in later aspects of the show here. But we're talking about, you said the community will be able to identify those needs. What has been identified to you? I mean, transportation obviously has been there. What is the one thing that's being identified as the issue here?
Well, transportation has always been there. I think we need to find ways that we have multiplayers come to the table, including the private sector. Mm-hmm. For example, we've had some discussions with Habitat for Humanity, which, you know, yes, they build one house at a time, but it's one family at a time that we're able to put a roof mm-hmm. over their head. They do a fantastic job, and we had a good discussion. As a matter of fact, I believe that we have a meeting scheduled to meet with some ministry official in Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing to, I'm going to say, pick their brains mm-hmm. and hopefully give them some flexibility, some government support to do even more, because they're, frankly, the people on the ground.
Well, even if they were to partner with something like co-op housing, for instance.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, co-op housing, it's multi-unit, but it's still sort of that, there's still a buy-in from the resident, right?
Absolutely. And I know, you know, I can tell you the private sector wants to get involved, but we also have to recognize that we have to find a way for that to happen. We talked about inclusionary zoning. When a developer wants to develop a subdivision or an apartment building, that a certain percentage of that property development has to contain some level of affordable housing. But we have to find the proper mix to make that work. And I know that, the private sector wants to help. We just haven't got to the proper mix. But I am confident that within, you know, not too distant future, we'll be able to do that. The other piece that I think it's also, I think, encouraging, we have to wait and see what happens, mm-hmm. is that the new federal government has committed to come back into the housing piece, because as you know, the former government was weaning itself out. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, if things stay the way they are, by 2031, there'll be absolutely no federal involvement when it comes to mm-hmm. public housing. So I'm encouraged that, and waiting to see where the new federal government, you know, is going with that piece. But we're, you know, but certainly I'm hopeful.
Well, one of the things Justin Trudeau said is that they want to create an investment bank, either a municipal investment bank or a provincial investment bank, or it's not an investment bank, rather an infrastructure bank where the provinces or municipalities could go and get funding. We're going to take our first break of the hour here, folks. You're listening to The Drive Time right here on Northumberland 89.7. My guest in studio is Lou Rinaldi. And we are talking about Ontario 2015, the year that was. Some of the things we're alluding to, of course, are what we can see in 2016. Now, you did mention the Ontario Retirement Pension Plan, and we will get to that. But before we went to the break, we were talking about infrastructure investment. And as I said, you know, the federal government is talking about creating an infrastructure bank for municipal and provincial governments. Although they are still, I mean, no, Mr. Morneau, the new finance minister, is a little concerned, though, because the projected deficit is going to be considerably higher than it was initially, because, of course, the numbers, but it's always like that when you get to be the new government, right? What can Ontarians look forward to, do you think, in terms of any kind of movement on that? Do you think that's something that's going to happen in the first 18 months?
Well, I think we need to wait until their first budget, which the federal budget, whenever they decide to come mm-hmm. out, I suspect February, March.
Yeah, they're saying February, March.
I mean, certainly they made some commitments during the campaign, and one of them specifically to infrastructure. Hence, Prime Minister Trudeau took a calculated risk or gamble to say that he was prepared to run a deficit for mm-hmm. you know, for the next 4 years, I believe, to make sure that we invest in infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And he got a mandate to do that. So, and it's a sizable infrastructure investment. It mirrors sort of what Ontario is trying to do over the long term, because we're not talking day by day.
No, well, the infrastructure plan, you're talking about $130 billion over 10 years, $13 billion a year.
Yeah.
The federal government is talking about, I think he said $10 billion.
So it's not, when you divide it amongst all the provinces, it's not a lot of money, but it's more than what was available before.
Mm-hmm.
So, if I'm sure we'll get some indication. I know I spoke to municipal folks in the last 2 or 3 months. They're anticipating, so when is that going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
I would guess, if I had a crystal ball here, that when the federal budget comes around, it'll have some indication, if not specifics, of how some of this infrastructure money is going to roll out. Because I think if provinces could tie in with that, we know that we can get a lot more done collectively than we can individually. Mm-hmm. So the province is committed to invest in infrastructure. We know it's crucial. Well, it's crucial for the economy, but it's also crucial that we have, even when we look locally, the deficit in infrastructure maintenance, like bridges, roads.
Water filtration facilities.
We made some headway, but we got a long way to go. We used to build them and then forget about them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, municipalities are asked to have asset management plans so that they know that the lifespan of Bridge A that we just replaced this year, we know that we have to replace it 20 years down the road, make sure that there's, money in the kitty to be able to rebuild that bridge.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the irony for you because, we talked about the generation that built this country, the ones that were willing to pay the additional tax so that they could get paved roads and new schools and water filtration systems and running water and sewers and all of these things. And the people of that generation said, yeah, we're going to pay for this because we know it's going to be infrastructure that's required. And they assumed, obviously wrongly, that over the long haul that this would be something that would be maintained, there'd be uptake, there would be vigilance on the part of the governments to ensure that the infrastructure that was being put in place right now, is maintained. And the best example I can get for the listening audience is, of course, 24 Sussex. Here is the Prime Minister's official residence.
Mm.
It's got asbestos in it. It's basically uninhabitable. And yet they've been using it, every prime minister over the last 35 years. Even Joe Clark's wife, even Pierre Trudeau's wife said when they lived there, the toilets didn't work. So, we're talking about the 70s now. So, a government that can't even maintain the official residence of the prime minister, I don't know what Canadians were assuming they would be able to do with maintaining infrastructure on the long haul. And, of course, that's been the responsibility of provincial governments now.
I'm not sure how true this is, but I heard not too long ago that in the city of Toronto, there's still places where there's wooden water pipes.
Yep, there is.
So we're good at building, and then we kind of walk away from the process.
Mm-hmm.
We have a deficit in new needs, whether, for example, if you look at now, transportation and the environment is a big issue. We should be able to have more trains that we can use every day to take cars off the road, but we just don't have the capacity to do it. So we need to get back into a stream of some type of asset management at all mm-hmm. levels of government so that we can gear. And the other piece as well is that, we've created a society of high expectations, which there's nothing wrong with it.
Comfortable.
And we all want to do better.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a cost associated with that as well. So we need to reconcile, what's important to people when we spend a dollar.
Well, that's that whole value for dollar aspect that the federal auditor general spoke of. Now, I know the province has had some problems with the auditor general provincially of late as well, talking about some of the spending that's gone on and where areas could have perhaps seen a better value for dollar. Is that something that they're saying just because it's – obviously they're nonpartisan. The Auditor General's role is a nonpartisan role. But are we really seeing sort of the remnants of that conservative aspect where, if people know where to spend their money better, you should be probably putting more money back into their pockets and stop wasting the money that you are wasting. How much money is actually being wasted at Queen's Park?
So, look, I'd be the first one to admit, I had the opportunity to serve both in government, both municipally and provincially, and at the county level as well. So, is there waste? There's always some type of waste somewhere. I mean, let's not hide from the fact. Sometimes folks take advantage of things that, you know, maybe they shouldn't, like if they were their own. So the ideal situation with in regards to the Auditor General, the fact is that it shines some lights on some of the things. The challenge with audits, and I have the pleasure of being the committee that I sit with the Auditor General on a weekly basis.
I'm going to put you on hold right there. We got a caller online. Go ahead, caller.
Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Hi. Is it okay to ask Mr. Rinaldi some questions?
Absolutely. The lines are open.
Okie dokie. All right. Well, the one thing was the particular government that's in now, the Liberal government, has had a fairly long run in the last little while, and we talk about infrastructure and stuff like that, but they haven't really, everybody says they know what the issues are, but nobody seems to be doing anything about it. There's a lot of talking. Again, studies are done, things are put on the shelf. How come, the question is, how come these things aren't being actually attended to? Like, looking at it doesn't mean anything. Why aren't they being attended to?
Do you have anything specifically that you want to address? I mean, well, I know there's all kinds of stuff.
There's all kinds of stuff. I mean, you know, the big one over here, of course, and it's, I understand it's not provincial, it's federal, but it's part of it. You know, they talk about infrastructure in Port Hope. We got this low-level radioactive waste deal going on. What kind of guarantees are we going to have that we're going to have, you know, local jobs out of this type of thing? You talk about bridges and infrastructure. How come money isn't being put into that, you know, actually being put into it instead of just studied? Why aren't things going on?
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
It's Ed White.
Oh, Ed, it's Lou Rinaldi.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in.
Yeah,
so,
no,
I mean, your question was very, very general. I mean, you talk about the issue in Port Hope right now. I know, and I'm not trying to defend the federal government here of the past years, but, you know, there's, I believe, a substantial amount of money that was put aside. It's in the bank. I don't know the exact numbers because I don't represent
somewhere like $1 billion, actually.
Something like that, if not more, to deal with a cleanup. There's an enormous amount. I can tell you that the amount, and I don't know how much the amount is that's been spent so far to get things set up. A lot of those jobs, and I know people that work there are local jobs.
Well, I know people that have retired from there.
That's right. So
it's been going on since the 70s, and if you look at it. And again, I realize this is not your deal, but it's just a government sort of deal. You look at it, nothing's been done. Okay, they got the mound, they got a nice road. We got they built the Palma Drive. That's a really nice road and a soccer field. But is that worth billions of dollars?
Well,
I don't know.
the job is not complete, but once again, I'm not trying to defend what they've done because I really don't know a lot about it. But the reality is that when you tackle issues like the cleanup in Port Hope, that's a major, major undertaking. There's been an awful lot of time, for example, spent. Where are they going to put this stuff? Because, nobody wants it on their backyard, right?
Yeah, that's what the mound is all about.
So, and they're trying to clean up backyards.
Yeah.
They're trying to clean up backyards.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's that piece that has
this is infrastructure, okay? This is, this is the type of thing when people say, oh, we got to invest more in infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
I look around and I go, okay, so build a bridge, you know, fix the roads. The highway here. You know.
So let me talk in general. For example, when you talk about where some of this infrastructure, for example, so you got, the 401 that's been progressively put into six lanes coming east.
Mm-hmm.
It's been done. So that's to me, it's infrastructure. The massive investment on the 407, the offshoot coming into the Ajax, Oshawa area. Look at the investment in local schools here starting a few years back from St. Mary's. And I'm not only talking about the present government. We're talking about, the addition that was put in at Coburg High School and some of the, public schools. So those are public dollars spending on public infrastructure. And I can tell you, I mean, I don't have it here with me, I have a list of support given to municipalities, whether they're building bridges. As Coburg here just this past year some preventative measures to prevent major flooding that might happen in Cobourg. Mm-hmm. There was those kind of so to me, that's infrastructure.
That's stuff being done.
Yes.
Yeah. There are things like that. It's just that I always hear everybody talking about, you know, well, we have questions about this, questions about that, but it just seems
everybody understands
yeah. what's going on.
Mm-hmm. One of the things we've got to remember, okay, in the province of Ontario right now, there's a deficit of over $100 billion mm-hmm. of not new infrastructure. This is to keep the old infrastructure rolling.
Right.
So there's always a huge need and a huge demand to keep up the infrastructure that we have.
So then I got to look at this thing like, okay, and I'm saying just as a regular taxpayer,
yep.
a regular guy, and, you know, yourself,
yep.
as just a regular guy,
yep.
you run a business.
I did.
We look at things like, okay, you come back to the millions and millions of dollars that were wasted on that, you know, gas plant thing, and then they're asking me to give money to the hospital so they can buy kidney machines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, how does that justify itself?
So I just so that you know, or that we all know, in 99.99% of the time, equipment for hospitals under any government since the inception were mostly provided from the community. The provincial governments in the past and present contribute about 85-90% to the fiscal plant, like to the bricks and mortar in general and some general equipment. But equipment, it's not just something new now. It's something that's been like that for, as far as I could remember. That, you know...
on a whim, they can just close a hospital. You know, they can just up and say, okay, well, this one's not getting enough business, or, you know, we're not going to put any more money into this one. You're going to close three floors and you know.
Which hospital are you referring to?
Well, I'm talking about these LEMs, or what is it?
You're talking about the LINS.
The LINS?
And just to be... fair, and that's what I'm all about here. You know, in Port Hope, you guys had a hospital. It was closed. Now, you had just spent a whole bunch of money. My understanding is the previous provincial government, and it was they who decided to build this new one. They decided, after spending a whole bunch of money on infrastructure for that very hospital, to close it. And then they were going to build this other one. So that really does go to your point where they can close it on a whim.
Yeah.
And you yourself, as the member for Quinte West here, you've got the Camelford Hospital, the three hospitals in that Trenton Health.
Well, I have the Trenton Hospital and, of course, Northumberland Hills Hospital.
But the Trenton Hospital is really three hospitals.
Well, Quinte Healthcare, it's four.
So, again, you've had to, because this does go to what you were saying, Ed, to the point that because the LINS have been saying to you, you've really been getting a lot of pressure as a member, and I know from the residents as well, saying, no, we want you to save our hospitals. From your own stand, I got to give credit where credit's due here, Ed. I mean, Lou really has busted his balls, and I'm using those terms, to ensure that those hospitals stay here. But that does go to your point.
No, and I mean, and rightfully so. I think, you know, just a touch on healthcare that you brought it up. So here's, and you know, David's right here. The Trent Memorial Hospital site, or the Foresight, the Quinte Healthcare, a year ago was really in the chopping block.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we made sure that the hospital is going to stay. It's going to maintain the emergency and some related. And we're working a bunch of other stuff that actually something very innovative that we'll be able to talk about within the next few months. But let me say this. I mean, sometimes, you know, especially with healthcare and hospitals, hospital have a real social attachment to people. I mean, you know, I live in Brighton, right? So Trenton is my hospital.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to say that it's not, although I can go to any hospital in the province of Ontario, but that is where my family uses. That's where we use it, hopefully not too often, but it's there. So you get this attachment to it. But to me, what's important, and I said this, you know, a number of times, over and over and over again, you know, to me, what's important when it comes to healthcare is to make sure communities get the adequate level of service, whatever that might be. So because sometimes we focus too much on the bricks and mortars and the beds. For example, we say, well, we got to protect these four walls. We got to protect these four beds. the reality is technology has changed so much that I use the example when, you know, my oldest daughter was born 44 years ago, and I think I got the year right. I might be corrected when I get home. You know, my wife was in the hospital for 7 days. No complication. That was normal.
Yeah.
My youngest grandson that's now seven, it was a day and a half.
No, we went through the same thing.
So those 5.5 days of free bed, you know, when I took my father 25 years ago to get his cataracts done, he was in the hospital, I believe it was 4 days. I went a year and a half ago, an hour and a half, I was in and out.
You'd be lucky if the chair got warm.
That's right. Yeah. So all I'm saying is, so to me, when I talk about do I want to have make sure people can get their cataract service in their community, yes. Do we need, you know, a 100-bed hospital to be able to do that? If there's nothing else to have done, I go. Well, you know, I'd rather be able to have a doctor there to perform the surgery.
Well, so, and I agree 100%. But again, getting back to just Joe taxpayer,
yeah.
You know, me looking at this,
mm-hmm.
I look at it and I go, okay, I go to the emergency ward. I want to see a nurse or nurses. I want somebody to take care of me.
Mm-hmm.
Then they tell me, oh, well, the administration of the hospital takes X number of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Well, they're not helping anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Why do the nurses, why are they always the cutback? Why is, you know?
So have you ever personally had a bad experience at a hospital? Because I'm curious to know. Because
actually, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm,
you don't have to talk about it. I mean,
yeah. Okay. I've had many good experiences, but I've also had bad experiences.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because so here's what happens. I mean, that's a common question asked to people when I talk about, you know, services. So you are one of the very, very few that's been able to tell me, yes, I was at a hospital and I had a bad experience. Because a lot of time it's hearsay. You know, whether they read it in a paper or they talk to a friend,
My cousin told me.
Well, so, I too can say yes to that question.
You know, so all I'm saying is, I'm not saying it's rare, but in many cases people say, well, no, I've never been to a hospital, but I've heard from it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, what I'm looking at more, Lou, is I'm looking at, you know, like the wait times in emergency wards, you know, stuff like that, you know, a little bit more equipment, a couple more staff members and whatnot. You could probably knock a couple hours out of somebody's stay, you know.
And, you know, I mean, how do I say this?
Well, I know what you're going to say. You know, like, nothing's perfect.
We got
it's better than nothing.
No, that's not what I was going to say. What I'm going to say, it's hard to predict what we need in an emergency
right.
room area. We don't know when a disaster happens in a 401, and I'm talking about locally here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We don't know those things. For example,
well, it's pretty common around here for people to say, oh, I'm not going to the emergency ward in the hospital. I'm going to go to Port Hope's walk-in clinic.
But you know, and I know, at least I'm anticipating here, that sometimes we use emergencies in emergency department when we really don't need to use
it. If somebody's got a cold.
That's right.
I agree.
So we use that kind of – we've allowed, and I'm not blaming anybody here. I'm saying we as governments and as people have allowed hospitals in the last 20 years to be a catch-all for everything.
Right.
And that's not what hospitals are meant to be. Hospitals are meant to be to deliver acute care.
Well, what do you think about the pharmacare type stuff?
You mean
Drugs. You know, like getting a drug plan going.
I think we should have a national drug plan. I couldn't agree with you more.
Think all the provinces to be in line with that? Would Ontario be in line with that?
We're in line. As a matter of fact, Minister Hoskins, our Minister of Health in the province of Ontario, is taking a leadership role to try to convince his counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
But just bear in mind, whether it's pensions, whether it's health care, which is universal across the country, it needs an enormous amount of support from every province. You know, the federal government, give them credit where credit is due, they cannot just impose that. There's health accord agreements that
right.
you need, you know, participation by all provinces. So,
and you also need a federal government who's willing to come to the table.
That's right.
Too, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the things that you've spoken to on our show, and I really want to thank you for calling in again, Ed, because one of the things that you have brought up on the show is, along with PharmaCare, is this idea that each province pays a different amount for the same drug. So if you, for instance, have a Biaxin as a generic penicillin, right? So you're getting Biaxin. Well, the price in Ontario is not the same price as Manitoba. It's not the same price as Saskatchewan or PEI or Nova Scotia. So what we really need, and this is something that Rana Ambrose was talking about during the federal election, and to try and keep some of those conservatives, because she said, look, we realize that there is that disparity between the provinces. And so they were talking about being the sole source provider of pharmaceuticals for provincial governments, the single payer, if you will, which is a great idea in my mind. And that's also something that Mr. Hoskins has been talking to his counterparts about, because that is going to go a long way in reducing the cost of health care in this province, right?
I think so. And you know what? It's the same old story, Ed, that I'm going to use your term here, as regular people on the street, like you and I and Dave here and whatever, once we have that kind of comfort, whether it's housing, for example, we know we're going to have a roof over our head. We know that we're sick. Somebody can look after us and give us drugs if we need some drugs. I think it increases the quality of life.
Oh, absolutely.
For those people.
Mm-hmm. It's just the stress level drops.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean,
stress level drops. Everybody's.
I mean, know. I can tell you, as you know, as past still somewhat small business owner in Canada, and we had four kids very close together. Sometimes, you know, we were afraid to go to the dentist. I feel bad for my kids, frankly, you know, because we knew that it was going to be, you know, $400, $500, $600 bill.
Well, you know what? Unfortunately, it's still that way, Luke.
It is. You but know, I'm
dental
using
care is, yep. Dental care is probably next on the list of things after drug care. You know,
yeah. So
I mean, the big thing is about doctors have been saying forever about no point us diagnosing stuff and recommending pills if they can't buy them.
Well, tell you something, I'm not going to mention any names, but I have a family member right now who is in extremely not well, and he's extremely not well because of tooth issues. He's had problems with his teeth for a long time. He does not have any dental coverage. He can't get any coverage through the province for whatever reason. And because, of course, all you can get is emergency care for dental through the province right now. So here's a guy who should have had some teeth pulled out a while back. And now he's, you know, over the last few days, he went septic at one point. He was in the hospital.
Wow.
Like, it's a very, very, very dire situation. And why? Because he doesn't have access to a dentist.
You can't afford it.
Yeah, you know?
You just deal with it. Yeah, I hear you.
That's a real case. I want to thank you for your call, Ed.
Yep, I got a scoot. I'm going to go and see if Port Hope's going to have any transit tomorrow.
Well, yes. You know what? Call me tomorrow and let me know. Interested in knowing how that's going to play out, because we talked about that on our year in review with Rob Washburn.
Thanks, Ed.
Thanks,
okay,
Ed.
Okay, thank you for answering the questions, Luke.
Anytime, Ed.
Bye now.
All right, so that was Ed White, our regular contributor, and thanks to him. I really appreciate it when we get some calls in from the callers. We are going to take our last break for the hour, and when we come back, we're going to continue to talk about some of the stuff that is coming up for 2016, the ice storm assistance payments, for instance, the Ontario Electricity Support Program, that's for people with low income, and, of course, the Ontario Retirement Pension Plan, the fourth leg of a three-legged stool, which looks more like a milking stool these days, I think. Ooh. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Ben Bird. Join me and Dave Glover on Mondays at 4 during the drive time for the Bird Report Live right here on Northumberland 89.7.
Welcome back, folks, to the drive time. No applause this time. That, of course, was Five Man Electro Band, I Am a Stranger Here, and we'll play that as our closing number today. Again, because it's a new year, right? We're all strangers in the new year, as far as I'm concerned. Speaking of I'm a Stranger Here, Lou, we have welcomed quite a number of refugees here from Syria. We were fortunate enough to have a couple of gentlemen who'd arrived here from Egypt, from Syria recently. And I just wanted to get your take on what's happening here locally, and maybe you can give us an update for the listeners anyway on what the provincial government's been doing.
So we've been following, of course, the federal lead, as you know. I mean, they're the ones that determine where refugees goes. And I know in Ontario we're going to receive over the period of time some 10,000 refugees, and some of them have started to arrive. I know locally there's groups here. There's been groups in the east end of the riding. I know there's a private group in Brighton where I live that they're hoping they've have one family of five already allocated, be here sometimes in February, March. And I believe I just heard the other day that they probably have to guarantee a certain amount of money in a bank and accommodation. And I believe they're very, very close to adopt another family of four or five folks. You know, there's been a lot of interest. I think, you know, Canada, as Canadians, I think we have, you know, the sense of wanting to help, which is fantastic. I mean, there's some folks that, you know, haven't been so supportive, and I'm going to be honest. But I will say, for me anyways, that number has been very, very small. And that's fair. I think we have to accept people's views. But, you know, as an immigrant, I wasn't a refugee, but as an immigrant in Canada, adopted me and some of these, from what I hear, some of the stories I started hearing already about some of the new land that refugees are now, you know, they have land of status.
Mm-hmm.
They're able to get a job. They're already actually working already.
Yep.
and producing. So
they're already paying taxes. That, you know, I you and I were talking about this earlier today. Alan Curdy, the little boy who died on the beach in Turkey, I believe it was Turkey or Spain.
I think it was Turkey.
His family has come over. They came over about a week ago. All his aunts and uncles and his aunt, who we all got to know on television, was there to greet them. They are actually already in business. They've managed to secure a space, and they have got their licenses. They're cutting hair in British Columbia. They opened a barbershop.
Wow.
So, I mean, this is something that happened with a matter of days.
Yeah.
So, obviously, some of that had been in place beforehand. The two gentlemen I spoke to that were guests on the show as well, both of them were brothers. They were partners in a business that manufactured windows for construction, as well as custom cabinetry for kitchens and spaces like that. We know that in the province of Ontario, that those are skilled trades are needed.
We need those.
So those guys, and I haven't been able to confirm this with the imams yet, but I'm pretty sure those boys are probably already working.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
So contributing members of society, right?
We're going to have hiccups. I mean, that's anything we do. I mean, when we talk about this, but I think in general, I mean, we have to remember that a province like Ontario already welcomes over 20,000 immigrants a year.
That's right.
So it's not something that's, you know, totally uncommon to Ontarians to. And this is really more from being a humanity-driven situation. I think Canadians are stepping up to the plate. And we as a province, I mean, I know we're going to make sure that they get the proper health care they deserve. And also be able to provide opportunities for especially kids that don't speak English, provide opportunities at school where they'll be able to learn the language. And I know that these people that come to Canada and Ontario want to be here to live in a safer society and to work and contribute. That's why they have that initiative that they want to come here in the first place. I mean, when I look, for example, although, like as I said before, my family immigrated to Canada because we wanted a better place to live.
That's right.
You know, and especially my parents then in their 40s, they want to make sure that my sister and I had an opportunity to live, as good of a life, if better than what my parents had. And you know what? They succeeded, and amongst many others. So these are a real challenging time for these refugees. But in general, I think at the end of the day, if things settle in their homeland, some of them might want to even go back.
The two guys I spoke to hope to one day be able to go back to Syria.
Wow.
That's their goal. I mean, they came here for refuge, and they were very, very, I mean, they were pretty clear. They had a thriving business over there. And they hope to one day get back to their thriving business and living their upwardly mobile lifestyle. I mean, these guys, you know, and they also pointed one other thing out to me as well, because, you know, we've heard a number of people say, well, you know, there's not enough work here in Canada for people. Why are we bringing people here? We should be taking care of our own first. But these are people who are, as I pointed out with the Curtis and these two gentlemen, they come here with skills. They come here with the ability. And they also come here with a desire to be successful.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not something you can teach.
Well, you know, if I reflect back a bit, and I, you know, you talk about things that you had an opportunity to touch, feel, and see. I mean, I remember when Germans, Italians, Greeks, folks from the Netherlands, folks from the UK came, and that's what built this great country, along with, you know, generations of Canadians are already here. So am I concerned that we're going to lose some of our identity? Canada and Ontario is a multicultural society.
Mm-hmm.
We have over 200, 200 different nationalities that live and work and play in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think we have a leg up when we talk about immigrants and we talk about, you know, bringing in refugees, because we've already acclimatized ourselves and we have some of those services to cater to the very needs of these refugees. So, you know, there'll be hiccups, but at the end of the day, I think as Canadians, we're able to welcome these folks with open arms and give them an opportunity to live a good life and actually help with some of the trades that we desperately need, allow some of those folks to flourish.
Well, Lou, I want to thank you for being here today, and hopefully we can. I know my people will talk to your people, and we'll set up if we can regular monthly meetings. As we were doing, we did that right up till just after the summer, just before the summer break. So we were doing it pretty regular. So we're going to set that up again, folks. So please keep your dial tuned here to Northumberland 89.7 Truly Local Radio. I'm Dave Glover. You've been listening to The Drive Time. My guest in studio today has been Lou Rinaldi, your member of provincial parliament for Northumberland Quinte West, and also John Ford, who is our resident go-to guy when it comes to energy, and I know he and Lou had a lovely discussion while the news was on during that break. And this is the kind of thing that we try to foster, because nothing sexier than a good conversation.
That's right.
Lou, I gotta
absolutely
say. Anyway, here they are, five-man electrical band. The song is "I'm a Stranger Here" from 1973. I'm Dave Glover. Thanks for tuning in, folks. I'll be back tomorrow.